I can see you guys.
No, it's all right.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Joe de Blasio on behalf of American Eagle Express, which I'll refer to as AEX. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You look like you're low.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Your bottle looks almost empty.
Yeah, it's been a long afternoon. Excuse me. Your Honor, today we're asking this court to reverse the decision of the lower court denying AEX's motion for judgment on the pleadings. Particularly, the motion asked the lower court to dismiss as preempted all the appellee's claims under the F-Quad A.
Why isn't Lupien dispositive?
Your Honor, I think Lupien is dispositive. Excuse me. I think Lupien is, it puts this court in a very unique position. So before Lupien, what did we have? We had precedent in the Seventh Circuit. We had precedent in the First Circuit. The only two circuits to squarely address the issue of misclassification of drivers under state ABC test. In the Seventh Circuit, we had Costello. In the First Circuit, before Costello, we had MBA. And then after Costello, we had Swan versus FedEx. Lupien puts this court in a very unique position. Lupien came before this court under New Jersey and Illinois state law. The New Jersey claims were dismissed, leaving it with Illinois state law claims only. Lupien itself was an absolute repeat of Costello in the Seventh Circuit. Now, what comes before this court is a claim under New Jersey state law, which is just as far-reaching as the Massachusetts state law. Now this court has a chance to decide...
Did you mean Illinois? You said Massachusetts.
No. This case today is right. Just the impacts of New Jersey law are, unlike Lupien, are just as far-reaching as Massachusetts.
Okay. So you're talking about Schwann, right?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You're talking about Schwann.
Sorry. I'm talking about Schwann, yes.
How is it as far-reaching? The language of the New Jersey statute has an extra clause that's not present in prong B that exists in the Massachusetts.
Your Honor, this is the argument that Appellee's counsel makes. It's the argument misses the point. The question isn't the ABC test. The question is, what are the impacts if the ABC test requires reclassification?
And the impacts that you have articulated for us are a list of, we may have to get our human resources, and maybe we're going to have to buy some vehicles, and maybe we're going to have to comply with some other laws. But those are just your statements, and this is not, we're stuck in the playoffs.
Yeah, how can we consider all of that?
Your Honor, this court must consider all that.
I'm so sorry. Help me.
Sure.
In this procedural posture, when it's a judgment on the pleading, similar to the motion to dismiss, not exactly, that was in Lupien, and the distinction that Judge Chigueras drew between what he had before him in Lupien and most of the other cases cited to him, that of those cases being summary judgment cases, his case being a motion to dismiss, we're stuck with the pleadings. So how are we to take, it's a massive amounts of information that you've given us. You know, it's going to cost us this, we're going to have to do that, etc. How do we take all that into account?
Very easy, Your Honor. And I think counsel for appellees would agree with me that this is the time to decide this issue, not in the discovery record. When you look at the four pillars of the Supreme Court precedent that create the framework, Northwest, Rollins, Morales, Roe, none of those cases used empirical data to decide the issue. When you look at the circuit court cases that have decided this issue, Costello, MDA for sure, even Schwann versus FedEx, even though that was a summary judgment motion, none of those courts used empirical data to make its decision.
Well, that would seem to hurt you because Lupien said we certainly can't grant at this stage. If there's any way we're going to grant it, it would be with more data, but Lupien ruled against the claim.
Your Honor, let me explain why Lupien ruled against the claim, and respectfully, Lupien didn't say we can't. It said it's not dispositive. Maybe we can. The reason why Lupien denied the projection application was because Lupien was a repeat of Costello. The impacts were minimal. In fact, this morning I had the pleasure of listening to the oral argument in the Lupien decision, and my adversary, Mr. Lipton, who will be representing the appellees in this matter, argued that case for the driver.
Let me cut through with the hypothetical.
Yeah, please.
Let me come with something that has a more direct impact. The state of New Jersey decides that it wants all its drivers to earn a living wage, and so it had all of its employees, not just drivers, so not limited to the transportation industry, $30 an hour minimum wage. Is your position that because on the face of the complaint, I can see that this is going to drive up the cost of deliveries as well as of hamburgers and everything else, but therefore there is automatically a carve-out of New Jersey state law just for delivery drivers because you can trace with a better causal line than the one you're talking about here, you can trace an impact between $30 an hour as the minimum wage and driving up the price of my FedEx or UPS or whatever deliveries here. Under your theory, is that preempted?
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason why it's preempted is because under that hypothetical scenario, if the court determined that the impact that the application of that state law has on the prices was significant enough, then absolutely it's preempted.
Yeah, first of all, you're getting into line drawing that I don't understand how we're supposed to do this on a judgment on the pleadings. Mm-hmm. Now, if we were further along, my hypothetical was better because mine was $50 an hour. But if we were further along in the proceedings, you know, both of our hypotheticals would be fun. The information that you put forth would be, you know, interesting. Where do you draw the line on significant? You know, the whole notion of the language on indirect result, does that influence how you think about significant? Great, but how do we do that in this context?
Your Honor, and let me explain it in maybe a little bit more depth. Like I said, the four pillars that we cite to, the four Supreme Court precedent, all of those cases decided the preemption issue without looking at factual discovery. The circuit court cases that have addressed this issue already have decided the issue without looking at factual discovery.
And Rollins said it wasn't preempted.
That's not true, Your Honor.
Costello said no preemption. That was a case you just cited to us.
And
Schwann said preemption, but Schwann's language was different, and they were
at a different posture. Right.
And, Your Honor, MDA also found that there was preemption. There wasn't a discovery record in MDA. In Schwann, even
But they
though,
didn't need a record because they could look at the language and see what it was requiring of it caused the entity to have to totally change its business model, correct?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Do we have that in front of us?
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. If I may address that, absolutely we have that in front of us. We're here on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. We're accepting as true all of the allegations in the complaint. MDA, you had to look at the ABC test because they needed standing. They came on a declaratory judgment. They said, this big problem, we can't meet it, so we have standing. Excuse me. Here, we don't need that step. We're assuming all the allegations are true. We're assuming the allegations that we've acted unlawfully and misclassified the drivers as independent contractors. So the only question before the court is, what then is the impact of that reclassification?
Here, here's what I think. There's a legal component. There's a component that maybe you can get to before at the complaint stage, and then the component that requires discovery. So the test is the effect has to be significant, and it has to not be too remote, tenuous, or peripheral. So certain kinds of indirect effects are going to be too remote or too tenuous, correct, even if they're large in a significant percentage-wise. So it might be as a matter of law, sometimes there's a proximate cause, there's an intervening cause or something, and you lose at a motion to dismiss stage. But I don't see how you can win at a motion to dismiss stage.
And the reason why is because the court doesn't look at factual discovery to decide the preemption issue. The Supreme Court mandated you look at the logical effect of the state statutory scheme. And that's what we're asking this court to do. That's what every court has done. And
How can we gauge the significance simply from your allegations that, as a matter of logic, if we assume we misclassified and therefore need to reclassify, as a matter of logic, it's going to have, quote, a significant effect. How do we judge that? What factors should we consider when we don't have a record in front of us that tells us the economic consequences?
Your Honor, that's what MDA did. That's what this first...
I'm asking you, how do we do that?
Because, as in Schwann, in this case, reclassification means completely changing the business model. Costello didn't require me changing the business model. Costello only required, I need to get the consent of the employees to make the deductions. I don't have to change anything else. Costello said, that's tenuous, remote, and peripheral. That's not significant. In Schwann, it was significant because you had to reshape the business model. In this case, we would have to reshape
this. This is a matter of armchair theory. Armchair neoclassical economics says that there's always going to be someone in a well-functioning market who's functioning right at the line of profitability. Competition is going to drive it down. So anytime you change anything that has any delta, any effect on the inputs, that's automatically going to drive it up. So there is no limiting principle to your rationale. We can sit back, we can say this slight increase to employee unemployment benefits, health care benefits, etc., is going to drive up prices a little bit, and then everything's going to be preempted under your rule.
You run the line, you cross the line when it goes from remote, tenuous, and peripheral to significant. Yeah. That's the question this court has to answer.
With his hypothetical, that would mean that you'd have to pick the right plaintiff, right? The right business to complain. Because a strong business would have no effect on its, no significant impact with, 2% increase. A small business, that same 2% increase, would bankrupt it, right? But we can't possibly be getting into those kind of questions on a judgment on the pleadings.
Do you think it's preempted as to certain employers and not as to other employers in the same market?
No, Your Honor, when you look at the precedent, when you look at the four Supreme Court cases, when you look at Costello, when you look at MDA and also Schwann, all of the courts, the Supreme Court and the Circuit Courts, engaged in this analysis and made it determined. In fact, in the Seventh Circuit before Costello, S.G. Johnson said, they described it as a line. It's either going to fall on the short side of the line or it's going to cross the line for preemption. This court's obligation, as I see it, is to engage in the analysis and look at what would be the impacts of reclassification in this case under New Jersey law, and would those impacts be significant enough to be more than tenuous, remote, and peripheral?
You want us to rely on Lupien, and you say that Lupien is actually, follow Lupien, take me home.
That's correct.
May I? Yeah. Okay, so in the penultimate paragraph of Lupien, Judge Shigeru says, we know that the BFX, Diltz, and Swan cases all were decided in the context of a summary judgment record and De Fiore with a trial record. And then he goes on to say why he's not going to rule in favor of Corey. So with that sort of framing of the analysis, how... I'm so sorry, I keep repeating myself, but how do we judges on the pleadings get there with Lupien saying what I just read?
Lupien did not say that this matter cannot be decided on a summary judgment, must be decided on a summary judgment motion. And again, Your Honor, I'm going to ask the court to look at more than just this one sentence. Look at Lupien in its totality. Look at the precedent that existed before Lupien, particularly the Supreme Court cases. Every court to address this issue has addressed it without looking at factual discovery. Let me say it this way. If we engaged in factual discovery, what would that tell us? That would tell us what's happened. The question before this court isn't what happened. The question before this court is, what would happen in the future should AEX be required to reclassify? What would be the impacts in the future should AEX be required to reclassify?
Should AEX, wouldn't it be market as a whole, that shippers as a whole are going to have to change their business models? Because you just said this isn't a plaintiff-by-plaintiff inquiry here.
That's correct, Your Honor, which is why in MVA, it was the trade association for same-day couriers, which is what AEX is, coming forward, and the First Circuit making a ruling without any factual discovery that the statute is preempted because of the impacts it would cause. Keep in mind in MVA, Your Honor, it was remanded to the district court to then, it reversed the denial of preemption, or the finding of no preemption. It was remanded to the district court. The district court then engaged in the analysis of what would be the impacts under Massachusetts law if they all had to be reclassified, found that with the First Circuit's framework, the claim was preempted. That would not appeal to the First Circuit, who affirmed the district court's ruling that there were sufficient significant impacts. The impacts in New Jersey would be the same as Massachusetts. The reason why Costello is different is the only issue before the case in Costello was the deductions from the wages. Costello allowed the employer, under that state statute, to accept itself, and this is right in footnote 13 of Lupien, allowed the employer to accept itself from that prohibition.
They had some kind of contractual...
Right, so as long as I get the employer's consent, I can still make deductions.
How do you deal with the fact that when Congress put in this preemption provision, it looked at the state of the law in certain states, and some of those states had ABC tests, like New Jersey's. By implication, Congress didn't say they were out. Congress spoke on subjects that they said were problematic. And so doesn't that, in and of itself, when we're in express preemption land, or where we have the presumption against preemption, and we look at Congress's goal here, it allowed those provisions to remain untouched. Shouldn't that persuade us that New Jersey's ABC test should also survive?
Your Honor, the answer to that is no, because Congress' design is to create the statutory framework. It's the role of the courts to then apply that framework. And here, and I know Your Honor has a question, but...
No, please, finish.
No, thank you. Your Honor, the role of the courts is to then interpret that preemption provision and figure out when does it apply. The courts have done that, and in NDA and Schwann, the court was presented with the exact same significant impacts that would be the impacts here, very different from Costello, and found this is requiring the motor carrier to reshape how it does its business, to switch from the preferred business model of independent contractors to the not preferred model of having employees, and all that flows from that conversion. That's exactly what would happen. The effects in this case are identical to the effects, and probably I would suggest, and I'm prepared to explain, more far-reaching than in Massachusetts.
Okay, so let me give you a hypo with two variations. The first is this is what's alleged in the complaint. The second is this is what comes out in discovery. My understanding is that express courier services often can't find a place to park. So they park in a loading zone or a waiting zone, and they get a bunch of tickets, right? These tickets can be very expensive. They're a substantial part they're budgeted for in the delivery of business. So a courier comes in and says, our delivery model of delivering to people is being impaired, and we're going to go out of business because of these parking tickets. So our position is that the FAA preempts the local parking citations. Let's assume these are not safety-related, like you're parking in the middle of an intersection, but you're parking somewhere where you can't stay that long and you get a very hefty ticket. In a lot of cities, that's true. Is that preempted at the motion to at the complaint stage? Is that going to be preempted if the discovery comes in and says the parking tickets are 7 or 9% of the budget of this company and it's really they're losing money because of that difference of 7 or 9%?
Your Honor, I think the analysis in that scenario would have to be, like in any FQA preemption scenario, is the impact of the state statutory scheme so significant that it has a significant impact on race rational services?
Let's assume it's going to drive the two weakest express couriers in this market out of business because they're operating on a margin of less than 9%. Is that significant?
Well, I think that's up to the court to decide. That's not the facts we have today. Those are not the facts I'm prepared to argue today.
I know. We need to draw a line.
But that's exactly right. And S.C. Johnson in the Seventh Circuit, which was before Costello, said that. Said, the FIA, the FQIA creates a line in the sand. I'm paraphrasing. Creates a line in the sand. The state statutory schemes at issue either fall on the short side of the line or they surpass the line.
I want to make sure what line you're talking about. The input-output line?
The line of whether the state statutory scheme at issue has a indirect, direct or indirect, significant impact on the rates, routes, and services of the motor carrier. In this case, and Your Honor, it feeds into one of the points appellees make.
So what's the answer? Is my answer that no, we can't dismiss against the courier, we might be able to give judgment on the pleadings in favor of the courier, we might be able to rule for the courier after discovery, but we can't rule against the courier, certainly at the motion to dismiss stage?
Your Honor, the ruling would be, whichever court it was before, would have to do the analysis that I'm asking this court to do, which is, does the logical effect of this statutory scheme have such an impact that is significant on rates, routes, or services? And it feeds into one of the arguments appellees make in this case, which is, well, these are general background laws. They don't directly impact the relationship between the motor carrier and the consumer, so they can't be preempted. We need laws that directly impact that relationship, and if it only impacts the relationship between the motor carrier and this workforce, then it can't be preempted. And we've seen that in this. That argument was made in MDA. It was rejected. It was made in Kwan. It was rejected. And Judge Greenway, I'd like to read from one of your decisions in 2008 under the Airline Deregulation Act. It was fantastic. And I'm about to read the best part of it. One of the arguments, this is Panage versus Continental Airlines from 2008, Airline Deregulation Act with the exact same preemption provision, the same language that the FQIA was modeled after. One of the arguments in the case was that, well, the FQIA, or in that case the ADA, does not preempt these general background laws, Your Honor, like we were talking about, where these are areas of traditional police powers. Mm-hmm. And, Your Honor, in a footnote, you wrote, referring to the Morales Supreme Court decision, the Supreme Court rejected the petitioner's argument that only state laws specifically addressed to the airline industry are preempted, and that the ADA, the Airline Deregulation Act, imposes no constraints on laws of general applicability. And then Your Honor cites to Morales. The footnote continues. The court stated that, quote, besides creating an utterly irrational loophole, there is little reason why state impairment of the federal scheme should be deemed acceptable as long as it is affected by the particularized application of a general statute. This notion similarly ignores the sweep of the related to language. And that's, again, citing to Morales. And that's the framework we have. It's the duty and obligation of this court now, without a factual record, because the factual record does not matter.
What was the procedural posture of that case?
Your Honor, it's in my folder there. I don't remember off the top of my head.
I'm sorry. I thought you were reading from the case.
I cut out the snippet and I stuck it in my little outline, so I'm sorry I don't have the actual decision, but I do have it with me.
You know, this seems like a great respite for us to listen to your colleague, and then you can tell me the procedural posture in a few minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Harold Lynch, and I have the great pleasure of representing the plaintiff's appellees. My brother starts with two falsehoods and builds the case upon those falsehoods, and they are absolutely false. The first is that they would have to convert to an independent employment model for all of the drivers. That is simply untrue. First of all, that's what BBEX held, a decision of the Seventh Circuit, and I can read you the quote, where they said that it's only have to make them employees for purposes of the wage statute. In this case, all we're talking about are the New Jersey wage statutes and the unemployment statute. There is no requirement generally that they be converted, and the Supreme Court of New Jersey, in the Weikert case, said, and I can quote, an individual may be considered an employer for some purposes, but an independent contractor for others. And that's been the law all over the country. If you're talking about master and servant, an accident, Social Security, there are many different tests for employment. These are just the tests for when the state is acting in its police powers to protect people's wages. And all the New Jersey statute says is you can't take money from someone's wages. You can't take deduct money, and that's improper. And you have to pay them overtime if they work more than 40 hours. It's much less onerous than the case of a marriage act in the 11th Circuit where they raised the minimum wage in the area where Miami-Dade's airport was to $15 an hour. It's much less onerous than requiring the payment of prevailing wage that was found not preempted by the 9th Circuit in Mendonca.
And so is Lupien dispositive here?
Lupien is dispositive. I'm going to tell you why. Lupien is not just dispositive on the issue of you can't decide this on the record, but they specifically talk about the difference between the Illinois statute and the Massachusetts statute. And my brother has said, well, this is just like the Massachusetts statute. That is a lie. Remember, in the Schwann case, in the NBA case, and I was the plaintiff's counsel in the Schwann case, they only preempted prong B of prong A, B, and C. A and C are still alive and well in Massachusetts.
Counselor, I'd be reticent about calling something a lie. If you disagree with his interpretation, that's fine, but I wouldn't impute any ill will.
I didn't mean it in that sense, Your Honor, and I apologize. But it's clear that what Lupien says and what Bivek says and what the First Circuit said in Schwann and in NDA is that there's a fundamental difference with respect to how prong B reads, which was the only thing they preempted. They said it would have to make everybody an employee for two reasons. The whole second part of the phrase, outside of all places of business, is removed from the Massachusetts statute. So if you're acting within the usual course of business, then there's nothing else to find other than someone has to be an employee. And the Massachusetts has an independent contractor statute that's a separate statute, and it applies, to put in the words of the Seventh Circuit and in Lupien, to a slew of statutes, thereby making all these requirements way outside the wage statute. Now, what's very important to understand to see the difference between these two statutory provisions, and again, it was only that second part of prong B that the First Circuit said was preempted, which doesn't exist in New Jersey, is you have a case in New Jersey, the Supreme Court decision, which we cite in our brief, of Carpet Remnant versus Department of Labor. Carpet Remnant were carpet installers. Those carpet installers were labeled as independent contractors, but day in and day out, they went into Carpet Remnant. They picked up, I guess, carpet remnants, and they installed them in people's houses. Now, under their theory, that would mean that those people would have to be treated as independent contractors. But the Supreme Court of New Jersey, in its wisdom, said no, those are independent contractors, and it reversed the Department of Labor's determination. And it reversed it for the following reason. First of all, the two prongs, A and C, control, are just like the common law, and C, which is whether you have an independently established trade or business, that's the common law too. The First Circuit had no problem with that. With respect to B, the Supreme Court of New Jersey found that those carpet installers, maybe they picked up the carpet at the carpet warehouse, but then they went out to people's houses, and that was not... that was outside the usual places of business, the second part of prong B, and therefore they found them to be independent contractors. Similarly, it's not at all clear on this record, and probably not the case, that these drivers...
Can I just interrupt for one second?
Sure.
I beg your pardon. What record are we talking about, right? We're looking at the pleadings, right?
We are looking at the pleadings.
So the cases that... let me ask this... sort of preparatory question to some others.
Right.
Your adversary in his briefing gave us a lot of information about what the projections would be if a certain scenario occurred. In your briefing, there was some response to it as well. My question is this: how are we in this procedural posture to take into account the various factual assertions that both you and your adversary.
I'm not making factual assertions, Your Honor. That is, there's no question that the second part of prong B, which is the only thing that the First Circuit found preempted, is fundamentally different. That's not a factual assertion. That's an assertion based upon how the law has been interpreted and how the New Jersey Supreme Court has interpreted its law. It said it does not have that second part, and that second part was the only concern of the First Circuit, and the First Circuit did not preempt the entire statute. So even if they were correct on everything here, we would still have, we saw the first part of prong B, the second part of prong B, we'd still have A and C, and those are legal matters. They're not really, there's no, in some strange way, I agree with my brother on the point that much of this can be determined on a legal basis because those two fundamental differences that I've articulated make this case fundamentally different than the First Circuit.
What is the legal test then? Because we obviously have educated ourselves about the various cases throughout the circuits that are grappling with whether the preemption provision somehow preempts a particular state law. You folks seem to work with this area all the time. Propose us a test, propose us factors, give us some legal guideposts that you think we should apply when examining a particular statute.
I've been waiting for that question for 5 years.
All righty then. I'm ready to hear the answer.
I'm going to amend her question in this procedural posture, not on a summary judgment record.
Yes. Every case,
whatever, you're the presider. That's
every case that has addressed the issue has found, as did the Third Circuit in Lupien, that there's a presumption against preemption, that when states are operating to enact basic police power laws affecting workers that are generally applicable to all workers, there should be no preemption because there's a presumption against preemption. That leaves the one decision, which is the First Circuit decision, that's preempted a certain section of the law. If that section doesn't appear, there's no preemption. That section, according to the First Circuit, this is the First Circuit's conclusion, was preempted for two reasons. First, they were impressed by the fact that it would be virtually impossible to have an independent contractor under that first prong, because if it's a delivery company and they're in the usual course of business, they would have to be an employee. You do not have that here in New Jersey as a matter of law because of the way the statute reads and the way Carpet Remnant interprets the statute. Secondly, unlike the New Jersey statute, which is a standalone independent contractor statute and then applies to quote Lupien, a slew of other labor and employment laws, it is clear that this ABC test that the Supreme Court of New Jersey has provided for in the wage and hour context only applies to overtime and to deductions, and it also applies, although it's not in this case, to unemployment. It does not apply to anything else. And so, therefore, the two things the First Circuit found dispositive and made it find preemption on that limited basis do not exist here, and that's as a matter of law.
Go ahead.
It sounds like what you're saying is the First Circuit was wrong, it should be limited to its facts, but we're thinking more in terms of what are the guideposts we give a lower court, and I think you started by saying general applicable laws and police power, but how do we formulate that? Are you thinking something about customer-facing versus employer-facing laws, or inputs versus outputs here?
Yes,
how do we phrase that as a test?
Sure. So that's a great question. When my brother talks about the Continental Airlines case and all that, all the decisions that they've cited, Morales and all that, that affected what Congress was intending to regulate. Congress wanted market forces to be governing the relationship between the shipper or the customer and the ABA, which is their airline passengers, and the company doing the shipping or providing the airline service. So that's direct. So there, if you have a law, even though it's indirect, let's say it's a consumer protection law, but a plaintiff is using it to say, well, my frequent flyer miles should be increased by 2,000, then you have a direct interplay that Congress was intending to affect when it enacted deregulation.
So what you're saying is, we know we have to allow some indirect claims, but only slightly indirect. And if it's employee facing is usually going to be too indirect.
Exactly, because as the Seventh Circuit said in S.C. Johnson, and you said, Your Honor, if you apply that analysis, then anything that a state tries to do to protect its workers, even if it has nothing to do with them as truck drivers or airline employees, would mean that it's preempted, even though the state has, you know, long before the Airline Deregulation Act and the FAA was enacted, states had laws to protect workers, and it's clear, as all the courts have said, that those police powers, there's a presumption against preemption, and that should not be overturned unless you can find that there was a congressional intent to do that, and in the employment field there clearly was not. It would be crazy when you think about it to think that in 1994, when Congress sub silentio enacted the FQAA, it intended to knock out all these labor and employment laws that was on the book. And as you know from the Ninth Circuit's Mendonca decision, at the time the FAA was enacted, Congress pointed out 10 states that had no regulation as those that would not be affected by the FAA, and 10 of those states all had wage laws. It's inconceivable that that's what Congress intended.
What would be the parameters for gauging when a law has a significant effect on a carrier's price, routes, and services? So now we're in the circumstance where it's not a direct effect, we're in indirect but significant. What are the meets and bounds for a court to consider to determine whether it's significant? The one area we see the Supreme Court speaking of is where someone's both at the Supreme Court in Roe and then in Dilts, the binds to, you're bound to have to do a particular thing. What other considerations can you think of on significance?
Sure. In the Dilts case, which involves meal and rest breaks, there was at least a more significant argument that by imposing meal and rest breaks, you were actually affecting the type of service and the routes that the drivers could drive, because they might have to not be on the highway so they could stop every 2 hours. And even that was found not to be preempted. As the state points out in their brief, that Congress, after these cases came down in 2017 and 2018, submitted an amendment to actually amend the FAA to put in a preemptive provision with respect to meal and rest breaks, and they cite that in their brief. That amendment is now dead. But it shows that Congress, it shows where Congress was concerned. So if you have a statute that actually directly affects the routes that the drivers are driving or the services or things like that. Now, it's very important to understand, because this is another, what I believe, a falsehood about the argument that my brother was making. They're saying, well, if we go to an employment model, we have to buy all the vehicles, and that's a big effect on our costs. And you can see where that argument has some plausibility. The problem with that argument is it's just not true. Not as a matter of fact, but as a matter of law. There's nothing that prevents an employer from requiring its employees or its workers or contractors, even if they're employees just for the wage statutes, from driving their own vehicles. If you all have been in law firms, you can ask your paralegal to go and do investigation and drive their car. You don't have to buy them that car. You don't even have to pay them. You might pay them because you're a good employer, but there's no requirement. As long as workers are getting minimum wage and they're getting overtime, and money's not being taken out of their checks, there's no requirement. New Jersey doesn't have an expense statute. Now, California has an expense statute, but New Jersey doesn't.
But so do you have any other examples besides a circumstance where it directs the corporation to provide a particular service or stop providing a particular service? Do you have any other examples of case law that talks about significant effect of a particular statute other than that scenario?
I'm just not sure what you mean.
We know that statutes that have state statutes have a direct effect on prices,
right,
rates, and services,
right,
are going to be preempted. Now we have a scenario where we have an indirect, it's going to have an indirect, but significant. Is there such an animal other than those statutes that dictate a particular service must be provided? Can you think of an example other than basically rubber pills?
What I would tell you is that although I don't agree with the conclusion, that if you read the First Circuit decision, It says that where you have a statute, even if it's an employment statute, that requires everybody to be an independent contractor, there's no way around it, and applies to a slew of statutes to raise the prices beyond anything that was raised in, you know, the prevailing wage law, and DACA, and the $15 an hour minimum wage in the Marriage Act, and things like that, you could have such such an incident. We are so far away from that here, Your Honor, that I think that would be, I don't think it's present.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you for chiming in. Thank you.
I hope that's okay.
Yeah. Well, I have some more.
Got it. Pat, sorry to step on your toes. The same things at the same time.
Same question came out of your mouth.
Good afternoon. Excuse me, Chris Weber from the Attorney General's Office in New Jersey.
Mr. Weber, yes. I'm sure you have some other things, but I hope at some point we get to your presentation of what the New Jersey's position is on the appropriate test here.
The appropriate test?
Yes.
Well, the appropriate test is clear. New Jersey abides by the ABC test. That was set forth in the statute, obviously, and upheld in the Hargrove versus Sleepy's case. And as Mr. Lincoln explained, actually, the Carpet Remnant case is pretty instructive on that as well, particularly with respect to the B prong, which I think is really the issue. Of course, it is in Schwann. It's a much less restrictive test in the B prong than it is in Schwann. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Were you asking what the preemption test should be?
Yes.
You were interested in, you have a view of what the test should be for us to advise our fellow judges on how to determine whether a state statute is preempted. What factors should they consider? What test needs to be satisfied?
The factors, I think the Diltz case is instructive on that. In Diltz, the court considered, the court noted, for instance, that prices weren't being set, that the state, the test there, the statute rather, was not mandating routes. It wasn't telling motor carriers what directions they should use. It wasn't directing them how they should perform their services. There is no bright line rule. There is no bright line test. The courts across the country have looked to a variety of factors. But the Diltz case, I would say, is instructive in that regard.
Your colleague mentioned the presumption. The presumption seems to arise in the dissents in Morales and Owens and the First Circuit in DiFiore. DiFiore mentions it. Is the presumption still good law in this four quad A context? Presumption against preemption?
Yes, and especially the state is here today because the consideration of the police powers that the state has the authority to invoke is paramount here. That is actually prominent in a lot of the Third Circuit cases. It's in Gary. It's also in the Lupien case recently, as well as Taj Mahal. This court has relied in large part on the protection of the state's police powers when deciding ADA or F quad A preemption.
So City of Columbus, that sound familiar?
Yes. I'm not sure that the police powers were invoked in the City of Columbus, but...
But the presumption against preemption.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a presumption against preemption, and in fact, as it's been discussed at length already, preemption only arises when there's a significant impact on prices, routes, and services, and that's just not... That's not something that the ABC test does. It does not significantly impact prices, routes, and services.
How do you respond to AEX's counsel's brief and comments about the consequences of having these employees deemed as employees? they ran through a whole laundry list of things, including they may have to pay additional benefits, et cetera. Do you have a response to that?
Any alleged connection there is simply too tenuous, remote, or peripheral. I think the Costello-BUX case is instructive on that regard. The court looked at the exact same test, the ABC test, and found that there was no connection there that was significantly impacting price of drugs and services. So I see that my time is already running low. I just want to emphasize here that the state is appearing as amicus to remind the court that it's important to recognize that the ABC test resides within its unemployment compensation laws. This is a crucial distinction that has not been raised in any of the other briefs or discussed in past decisions. And it's important to note that because the ABC test resides within unemployment compensation laws, it's protected from F-Quad A preemption by the Social Security Act and the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. The doctrine of preemption was simply not intended to undo decades of New Deal legislation, and that's exactly what the ABC test is here. It was enacted in 1936 as a part of that widespread New Deal legislation.
But doesn't that only helps you with the unemployment compensation provision? The ABC test, as it applies to the wage laws at issue in this case, are separate, aren't they?
That's true, but the statute itself resides within the unemployment compensation laws, and therefore the statute is entitled to the protection that FUTA affords, the Federal Unemployment Tax Act.
So your understanding of what the defendant is arguing is that the ABC test in its entirety is preempted for all purposes, and the consequence of a ruling in that way would impact the unemployment laws, and those are blessed by federal law, and as a result they're co-equal, and the Supremacy Clause should protect that.
We would argue that they are empowered, in fact, by the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, correct. It's just the doctrine of preemption was simply not intended to unspool decades of this legislation. The federal I just want to point out the statute. It's cited in the brief. Within the FUTA scheme, 26 U.S.C. 3305A, it prohibits avoiding unemployment contributions on the grounds that a person is engaged in interstate commerce. The F-Quad A was enacted, the preemptive provision of the F-Quad A was enacted to protect interstate commerce. So to argue that the ABC test is preempted based on the F-Quad A is simply the wrong mechanism. The defendants in this case may want to argue that their workers are independent contractors, but the F-Quad A is not the appropriate mechanism to argue that's the case.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I know you have some thoughts, but can you respond to whether we should be concerned about the consequence of a ruling here, or is your request of this court to find only the ABC test is preempted insofar as it applies to the two New Jersey statutes at issue?
Correct, Your Honor. So we're not seeking to invalidate the ABC test. We're not here to say the state doesn't have the authority to construct or implement or enforce such a test. What we're saying is when that test is applied to a motor carrier, and the effect of that reclassification has a significant impact on rates, routes, and services in that limited context, which is the context we have here, it is preempted and cannot be applied. Your Honor, Judge Schwartz, you asked, give me an example of such an animal where, it's an indirect effect, and the indirect effect is so significant that it's preempted because of the significant impact on rates, routes, or services. That's exactly what was before the First Circuit in Schwann. It's the exact issue before the court today. Now, counsel tried to deflect that case by saying, well, we're talking about a different B prong in MVA and in the First Circuit. The only reason why the B prong became important was because in MVA, the trade association came forward in a declaratory judgment action saying, under this test, we can never meet it. So all of our drivers were admitting they must be reclassified. Now, court, let's look at the impacts of that to see if it's preempted. That's the analysis we have to look at. We're beyond the New Jersey ABC test. We're on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. We're accepting all the allegations is true. We're accepting that we've misclassified the drivers for the purpose of this motion. Now we have to get to the next step. What is the impact of that reclassification? So it turns on one issue. And counsel Mr. Lipton said, well, if you're an independent contractor for one, that doesn't mean you're an independent contractor for all. That exact argument was asserted in Schwann versus FedEx. The First Circuit rejected it. In MVA on remand and in the First Circuit. And in MVA on remand, the district court faced that argument and said, the practical and significant reality is that the reclassification will trigger a host of other laws. Counsel for appellees in this case, in their opposition brief, say, yeah, Massachusetts was different because they thought it would have resulted in days off, parental leave, breaks, minimum wage, overtime, reimbursement. This is appellee's brief at page 28. All those same things apply here under New Jersey law. If someone is an employee, reclassified as an employee under New Jersey law, well, as of October 29th, just a few days ago, there's now a paid sick leave law, there's a paid family leave law, there's a leave, 12 weeks of leave under New Jersey family
leave. The only issue in front of the court by way of the complaint is whether they're employees for the purposes of two specific New Jersey wage laws. So the consequences of this only would involve those two. That's the only issue that would come out of, if this case goes back to the district court, that's the only issue that would be
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. All of the consequences of that reclassification under the wage law, if not, are exactly the issue that this court has to decide. If I have to now put these employees on my payroll and make payroll deductions and withholdings and treat them as W-2 employees, there's no way in the world I'm going to be able to argue, but I don't have to give them family leave. I don't have to give them paid sick leave. I don't have to give them leave under the New Jersey Safe Act for victims of domestic violence or leave. All of the leave statutes that come into play, that's the consequence. This is why the reshaping of the business model is so significant and why in Schwann the First Circuit said this is a state dictating to a motor carrier how it must provide its service. That is exactly what Congress intended to preempt. And I'd like to say one more thing about Lupien, because I started with Lupien saying it is dispositive. This is why it's dispositive. In Lupien, the court had a restatement of the issue in Costello, the very limited Illinois state law. It limited because the only issue in the case was making the deductions from pay. That state statute allows the employer to still make the deduction as long as they get the consent of the employee. Costello said, and Lupien, and in this court Lupien said, that's a very insignificant impact because you're only acquiring the transaction cost of getting their consent. Nothing else has to change. Now this court has the opportunity to address Schwann, and in Lupien, the court held in talking about Schwann, and I'm reading the third to last paragraph, the court, in referring to the Schwann court, the court considering the party's cross motions for summary judgment held that the FQAA preempted the MICS, the Massachusetts Independent Contractor Statute, basing its holding on the broad sweep of the MICS's regulation. The opinion noted that the MICS provided for a comprehensive regulatory scheme that would, in substance, bar FedEx from using any individuals as full-fledged independent contractors. That's exactly what would happen in this case. So this court already decided the restatement of Costello. Now it has the chance to decide a restatement of Schwann. And the result in this case should be the identical result in Schwann. If for some reason it's not, then we have a hard and fast circuit split. Right now, everyone argues on the other side that there is no circuit split. They're factually distinguishable because the issues in Costello are so limited. It's just wage deductions. And even the court in Lupien in footnote 13 says, furthermore, unlike the wage deduction provision in the IWPCA, the Massachusetts law barred the employer from accepting itself by contract. So it's significant that you're all talking about wage reductions in Costello and in Lupien. You're talking about a prohibition that you could accept yourself from by agreement. It has no impact.
All right, so the sentence before, the sentence that you read to us, says the court considering the parties' cross motions for summary judgment. So
that's correct.
So I presume your point is the fact that Swan was in a different procedural posture should be of no consequence in our ruling.
Your Honor, I'll answer that this way. It is of no consequence because when you look at Swan, when the court went through the preemption analysis, there was not a single mention of discovery factual record. The court engaged in the logical impact of the statute. I look back at Your Honor's decision in Continental Airlines. It was also cross motions for summary judgment. When I looked at Your Honor's explanation of the preemption issue, there was not a single reference to discovery or factual record. And in fact, what Your Honor held in that case, the issue on preemption that you were confronted with was, is, so the issue was the plaintiff's...
Well, the first question is, was I affirmed?
There was no...
Because I was on the district court in no way.
Such a good decision, there's no appellate history to it. But Your Honor, so briefly, if I may, the issue in the case under the Airline Deregulation Act, the plaintiffs brought a public accommodation failure to accommodate case under the New Jersey law against discrimination in the public accommodation context because the plaintiff asked that the airline not distribute peanuts on the flight due to a very severe peanut allergy. Right, so this presented a very severe allergy. The airline refused the request, provided the peanuts on the flight anyway. There was a lawsuit that followed. The question on preemption that Your Honor was confronted with was, is the provision of peanuts and food and beverages a service? So we know that it's preempted if it relates to a rate matter service. Is it a service? You were confronted with that question. Your Honor found that it was a service, and in doing so, you rejected precedent from the Ninth Circuit that said service means transporting a passenger from point A to point B. Anything else is too far away, not really a service. Your Honor rejected that, adopted the First Circuit approach and said that is a service, and therefore Your Honor found preemption.
Right. But it's still a customer facing, it still affects the customer experience, which is why the child or whoever the plaintiff cared about it.
Well, right, so what we have here, Your Honor, is a state ABC test. So the question is, can a state ABC test be preempted?
Nothing else.
Okay. I'm sorry.
It's okay, go ahead.
Go ahead. So the question is, you know, can a state ABC test be preempted? The answer is very simple. It can be preempted if application of that test, the natural consequences of that reclassification are so significant on lease, routes, and services that it's preempted. If they're too tenuous, remote, or peripheral, then they're not preempted. That's the test. So Your Honor asked for the test. Here's the test, and it's in both parties. It's in both parties' briefings. The test is a state law is sufficiently related to a rate matter service of a motor carrier if the state law has a significant impact on the carrier's rates, routes, or services. That's the test. So this case is Schwann. Lupien was Costello. Again, if this court declines to reverse the lower court, we have a clear circuit split between this circuit and the First Circuit because of the far-reaching impacts of the New Jersey law, very distinguishable from the impacts in the limited Illinois law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Counsel, thank you for your arguments. I will take the matter under advisement.